there will resume border checks to stop undocumented migrants. Overnight, German police investigated a suspicious fire that injured three migrants in a group home in the town of Rottenburg. It was the second suspected arson of a migrant building in southwestern Germany in 4 days. Also, one of the main coalition partners of German Chancellor Merkel's government chastised her for opening the borders, even temporarily. The faction's leader, Bavarian Premier Horst Seehofer, told reporters, "We in the EU can't keep taking in refugees from different countries over the long term. No society can survive that." Despite a contentious meeting in Berlin last night, the ruling coalition announced it would spend an additional $7 billion to deal with a quadrupling of asylum seekers in Germany this year. Half the money will go to states and cities charged with resettling them. But the coalition also announced steps making it more difficult for many migrants to get asylum here, especially those from the Balkans. And monthly cash payments to new migrants could soon be replaced with coupons for food and clothing in a bid to make Germany a less attractive destination. But German Labor and Social Affairs Minister Andrea Nahles offered some good news to the newcomers, namely federal help to get them into the job market. In an interview with German public television network ARD, she says the migrants are a large, if unrealized, gift for Germany, which is struggling with an aging population and acute labor shortage. Nahles says her agency is quickly working to offer more language courses and what training migrants need so they can be integrated into the German workforce. Soraya Serhadi Nelson, NPR News, Munich.
David Blanchard of Oregon Public Broadcasting contributed to this report. And as Soraya suggests, Europe's sudden open arms approach may not last. And as a New York Times editorial put it on Friday, some European officials may be tempted to adopt the hardline approach Australia has used to stem a similar tide of migrants. That would be unconscionable. But as Michael Sullivan reports, Australia has found it works.
Prime Minister Tony Abbott came to power in 2013 promising to stop the boats carrying migrants from the Middle East, from South Asia and elsewhere. And he pretty much has. Operation Sovereign Borders, as the Times pointed out, a ruthlessly effective effort to keep boatloads of migrants, many of them refugees, from reaching Australia's shores. And it's ongoing.
I have an important message for people who are thinking of travelling to Australia illegally by boat.
That's Peter Dutton, Australia's Minister for Immigration and Border Protection.
Do not believe the lies of people smugglers. The Australian government will continue to implement tough measures to protect our borders and is committed to ending the criminal activity of people smuggling. The way to Australia is closed.
The Australian Navy makes sure of it, turning boats back to their point of origin, usually Indonesia, sometimes resorting to highly unusual, some say illegal, measures to keep the migrants from reaching Australian waters. In June, reportedly paying an Indonesian boat captain a boatload of Benjamins, $30,000 in cash, to take his human cargo back to Indonesia. An account Prime Minister Abbott did not dispute in this interview with Australian Radio 3AW host Neil Mitchell.
These allegations that Australia paid people smugglers to turn back the boats, did it happen or not?
Well, Neil, we don't comment on operational matters, but we are determined to ensure that illegal boats don't get to Australia. And we will do whatever is reasonably necessary to protect our country from the effect of this evil and damaging trade.
But surely we wouldn't pay people smugglers. They're criminals.
Well, what we do is we stop the boats by hook or by crook, because that's what we've got to do and that's what we've successfully done.
Abbott has urged European officials to consider the Australian model, most recently after last week's horrific photos of a dead Syrian child on a Turkish beach. If you want to stop the drownings, he told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, you've got to stop the boats.
I don't think anybody should listen to Tony Abbott about anything to do with refugees.
Phil Robertson is Deputy Asia Director for Human Rights Watch in Bangkok, and he says he hopes the European Union lets Tony Abbott's calls go to voicemail if he tries to offer the EU advice.
Tony Abbott's solution for refugees was perhaps best seen during the Rohingya boat people crisis here in Southeast Asia, when the BBC and others found the Rohingya starving in these crammed boats. And Tony Abbott said he didn't really think he saw anything wrong by trying to push them back.
And Robertson says they'll be coming back now that the monsoon is almost over. Rohingya from Myanmar, Bangladeshis, and others fleeing persecution or economic refugees will get on smugglers' boats and take their chances. The refugee crisis, a worldwide problem, he says, that needs a coordinated solution. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai, Thailand.
On this Labor Day, let's talk about an essential job that fewer people are qualified for. America needs more welders, and soon. As older welders retire, there aren't many young people following in their footsteps. From member station WABE in Atlanta, Susanna Capelluto reports on a creative way to get skilled workers into the workforce.
In the 80s, when Flashdance brought us Alex, the welding woman who really wanted to be a ballet dancer, America had well over 500,000 welders. Welding was hot. Today, there are about 40% fewer welders.
I think there's right at 300,000 jobs right now in the U.S. that needs welders right now.
Jeremy Worley teaches welding at a technical college in North Georgia. He says the demand for welders is at a level that is growing
quicker than we can get them out.
So Worley will teach welding to anyone at any age, anywhere, including inside Walker State Prison. As part of its ongoing prison reform, Georgia decided to give inmates heavy tools and blowtorches so they can get a welding certificate. 26-year-old Christopher Peoples is practicing what's called a T-joint. He's at the end of a mandatory 10-year prison sentence he got for armed robbery when he was barely 17.
If it's an opportunity for me to dive into welding and they say I have a job here, I'm going to say that's me.
I'm a very good welder.
John Turner is an alumni of the prison welding program. He got out last month and had 3 job offers.
One of the other prospects was in Cherokee County, and it was just too far to travel, but he was offering $50,000 a year with a company truck.
He took less pay for a job closer to home. His new colleagues know he has a prison record, but he says they welcomed him. Gardner Garrick is with the Manufacturing Institute in Washington, D.C. That's the training arm of the National Association of Manufacturers. He supports prison programs like the one in Georgia.
We certainly would love to see prisoners successfully reintegrate into the community and into the economy. So if welding is a vehicle by which that can happen, then I think that's great to hear.
But that's only a drop in the bucket to fill the demand. Carrick blames U.S. education policy for the lack of skilled labor in the U.S. Think No Child Left Behind.
We made the decision that all kids should go to college. And as a result, you saw the elimination of a lot of the technical programs at the high school level.
Carrick's group is pushing for more skills training and programs that make manufacturing careers attractive to teenagers. And many companies have started their own apprenticeship programs. For NPR News, I'm Susanna Capelluto in Atlanta.
This is NPR News.
Good morning, it's 8:18, and you are listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later this hour, our series on sports and health continues. NPR's recent poll conducted with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health found low-income Americans do not participate in sports as much as they would like to due to the cost of taking part in both sports and exercise. Learn more on that issue coming up in about 20 minutes.
Support comes from Gateway Technical College. Are you creative? Got a flair for home decorating? Channel your skills into an exciting and diverse career with an associate's degree in interior design. Turn concepts into reality through hands-on learning, seminars, and internships. Information at gtc.edu/programs.
The music of Los Angeles to Madison Central Park on Thursday, September 10th. WPR is pleased to support music that brings people together. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Moscow is responding to U.S. concerns about Russia's military influence in Syria. NPR's Corey Flintoff reports.
Secretary of State John Kerry called Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov on Friday to express concern over Russia's military intentions in Syria. The move was prompted by reports that Russian military planners may be preparing to expand an air base near Damascus. Lavrov told Kerry that it's premature to talk about Russia's potential role in military operations in Syria.
A Russian news agency reports Moscow admits to supplying military equipment to Syria, but Russia says it's to be used in the fight against terrorism. There's no trading on Wall Street because of the Labor Day holiday. Stocks in Asia closed mostly lower today, though shares in Japan rebounded from seven-month lows. Officials at the Indianapolis Zoo are investigating how a cheetah managed to escape from its enclosure. It prompted a one-hour lockdown at the zoo yesterday. Judy Palermo is a zoo spokeswoman.
Our emergency response team went to the cheetah area. The cheetah was still lying down in the landscape area. They were able to dart it and sedate it. Once it was darted, it immediately went back down into the exhibit and went into holding on his own.
And nobody was injured. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. A Republican legislator is pushing a bill that would ensure high-capacity well owners could replace, repair, or sell their wells without state approval. The bill's main author, Senator Rick Gudex of Fond du Lac, says the bill is a reaction to an administrative law judge's ruling last year requiring the Department of Natural Resources to consider the cumulative effects of high-capacity wells on groundwater. He says the bill ensures that the DNR cannot apply that new standard to approved wells. Under the bill, a well owner who wants to replace, reconstruct, or transfer ownership of a well would have to notify the DNR but would not need approval. The League of Conservation Voters opposes the bill. The League says the measure would ensure well approvals never get reviewed. The Kewaunee Power Station is being dismantled after it has not generated a kilowatt of power in 2 years. Dominion Resources Incorporated says the plant is all but worthless, but the town of Carlton says it's worth $457 million. That's the Lake Michigan town where the plant pumped out electricity for four decades. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports those views put the two sides nearly on $500 million apart in determining the value of the facility for tax purposes. A circuit judge in Kewaunee County will have to sort it all out. Dominion took the town to court last month. This is Wisconsin Public Radio News. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University Bloomington, seeking comprehensive solutions for complex problems in the U.S. and globally. SPIA is committed to advancing knowledge for the greater good. From Farmers Insurance, out to educate everybody about common insurance gaps that can be costly so that no one falls victim to them again. Farmers Insurance. Know the gaps. Learn more at farmers.com/innercircle. And from Vonage, working to transform communications for business with cloud-based solutions, infrastructure that grows as a company grows, and seamless mobility across devices. Learn more at vonage.com. Vonage, the business of better.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Protesters in Guatemala have just toppled one president, widely believed to be corrupt, and with yesterday's presidential election, the country is headed for change. What is not clear is whether that will be a change for the better. The top candidates include a political boss from the old guard and a comedian who was part of the protests. Votes are still being counted this morning, and a runoff is all but certain. For more, we're joined in our studio by Eric Olson of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good morning.
Give us a little history here, if you would. Tell us about the scandal that drove out, ultimately, President Otto Perez Molina.
Well, about 4 months ago, the Attorney General of Guatemala announced that she had been carrying out an extensive investigation into fraud in the tax collection office. Initially, she didn't have information that linked the president to it, but about 2 weeks ago, she announced that indeed she did have specific information that the president was involved in probably leading a criminal network of receiving bribes in exchange for paying export duties. And so that became the basis of this latest movement to push him out of office, and he's now in jail.
Which I would think would be a big deal in Guatemala.
Well, there have been many corruption scandals in the past, and former presidents have served time in jail, no doubt, but this is the first time that a sitting president has been accused of corruption and forced out of office and into jail. Yes, it's a big deal.
This was a big deal then for protesters who managed to oust, basically, although he resigned the president. They have been in protest mode. Now the country is in election mode. And what are they looking at in terms of possible future leaders?
Well, this is the big challenge, because the top contenders are really questionable from the perspective of many people. One of those top candidates is an old style political boss who runs a political machine based in the rural sectors of Guatemala. His name is Manuel Baldizón. He's a very wealthy businessman, but there's always been questions about the sources of his income and his connections to other criminal networks in the country. They're involved in contraband, and some people believe that they were involved in drug trafficking. The other top candidate who is likely to go on to the second round is a man named Jimmy Morales. Jimmy Morales is a clown, literally a clown, a comedian who does stand-up comedy and other skits. He has zero political experience, and so people are voting for him more as a protest, more looking for a non-politician. But there are some real serious questions about his capacity to run the country as well. So we don't know who the top two candidates are going to be yet, but there's a lot of ambivalence about the options before the people of Guatemala.
Well, then, in short, Guatemala is facing a real question mark about whether that country will see an end to corruption and bad leadership.
That's true. I think there's a lot of questions about that, and that's why there's a whole movement afoot to push for deep reforms in the electoral process, deep reforms in how Congress is named and organized, and deep reforms into campaign finance, because there's been an enormous amount of corruption and dirty money getting into the system in that way.
Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Eric Olson is Associate Director of the Latin American Program at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Amid the chaos and conflict in the Middle East, there are still some strange and beautiful places to be found. Decades ago, Lebanon was more peaceful and cosmopolitan than it is today, and it was graced with the work of the famous architect Oscar Niemeyer. In this encore presentation, NPR's Alice Fordham visits one of Niemeyer's modernist buildings, a curious relic of happier times.
Lebanon's northern city of Tripoli is known for Arabic suites, intermittent sectarian violence, and Oriental architecture. So it's a jolt to step into a park with kids playing around a series of sweeping white curved buildings.
This space from there until the end is the space of the exhibition.
I'm on a walking tour led by Mira Mankara, a Tripoli native, at an international fairground. It was designed by the late Brazilian architect Oscar Niemeyer. In 250 acres of blossoming garden, there's the exhibition space, a pavilion with tapering columns and undulating walls, and a vast, slender arch towering over it all.
He didn't like borders. He didn't like limits. The inside and the outside are all, like, mixed together, and that's exactly what he wanted to do.
It was finished in 1974, just as Lebanon's bloody 15-year civil war broke out, and was never used for its original purpose. But the structures remain.
We go down.
Minkara leads us into an underground space domed with smooth, exposed concrete.
Basically, this is the experimental theater.
It wasn't meant to echo like this. The acoustics were never finished, but artists and musicians like to record here. And a group of visiting children runs riot. The fairground was also caught up in the civil war. When Syrian troops intervened, they used it as a base.
Actually, the tanks of the Syrians were all over here, and actually the Syrians were living in these buildings.
Minkara points out an underground space and a wall spattered with bullet holes.
They could do anything they want. Probably down was the torture places, like where they took the detainees and tortured them, and this is the execution wall.
Most of the visitors are Lebanese and say they were surprised by the scale of this little-known architectural wonder. The tour group heads to a lively cafe for a hummus lunch. One of them, Yolanda Farhad, says she was nervous to come to Tripoli because of the fighting that sometimes breaks out here.
It's interesting to come, but really I'm afraid to come alone.
But she loved the fairground. Her brother William lived in the US for 20 years and wishes the fairground was still in use, like the site of a 1961 World's Fair in Seattle.
I was really brokenhearted, to be honest with you.
The park isn't open to the general public. But the UN uses it for children's events. The city threw a festival there. Tens of thousands of people partied under that huge, graceful arch, while fireworks burst into light above it. Alice Fordham, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Provide higher education to prison inmates, and when they get out, their advocates say fewer of them come back. Without that education?
If we just stay the people that we are when we come in, without any opportunity to better ourselves, we're going to get out that same person.
But college credit for prisoners is controversial. San Quentin's higher ed program later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in to All Things Considered at 3 this afternoon here on Wisconsin Public Radio and online at WPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. For decades, Finland's government has sent expectant mothers a box of baby supplies. Then the box traditionally becomes the newborn's first bed. One university city in Finland is now extending the tradition to college kids there. They're called survival packs. Inside is a bus pass, bed sheets, socks, and a pack of dry porridge. Sounds like baby stuff. A local paper suggests including bike locks and fizzy orange pop to cure hangovers. It's Morning Edition.
Good morning. It's 8:31. Thanks for tuning in to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up later this hour, gardeners across the Midwest are planting thousands of milkweed plants in hopes of helping the monarch butterfly population rebound. The disappearance of milkweed, a critical food source for monarchs, is leading to huge butterfly losses. One group wants to send out 100,000 plants to create monarch stations along the migration trail where the butterflies can lay their eggs.
Support for WPR comes from the Wet Whistle Wine Festival, Friday and Saturday, September 11th and 12th in Algoma, featuring wine tasting, a fine art fair, and live music with a Saturday grape stomp. Information at algoma.org.
Support comes from the Racine Theater Guild, staging Calendar Girls, a comical true life story of average women mustering the courage to strike risque poses for a charity fundraiser. For tickets and for real-life calendars featuring the Racine cast, visit racinetheater.org.
Lift your spirit and enrich your mind with Wisconsin Public Television's performance, art, and drama offerings. Satisfy your curiosity with Wednesday night science programs and learn more through weekend how-to broadcasts. Go to WPT.org for detailed broadcast information, and while there, sign up for an e-newsletter about upcoming broadcasts and events.
It's going to be a cloudy Labor Day across most of Wisconsin today. Expect a chance of showers and thunderstorms through the day, highs near 80. And tonight, partly to mostly cloudy with a chance of rain showers and a slight chance of thunderstorms through the night, lows in the mid-50s to lower 60s. Tomorrow, again, mostly to partly cloudy, and those rain showers again are likely, so are a chance of thunderstorms, highs in the mids to upper 70s, and Wednesday, mostly clear.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from TIAA CREF, a global financial company dedicated to delivering financial outcomes that matter. TIAA CREF, created to serve, built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org. And from America's Natural Gas, learn how combining solar and natural gas at a Florida power plant makes it possible to generate electricity 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even when the sun isn't shining. ThinkAboutIt.org.
Good morning. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Today in your health, more about sports and money. According to a recent poll NPR conducted with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, money has a lot to do with whether low-income Americans and their children get a chance to play sports. NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
You could say Matt Ray lives and works in Paradise, a beach town and barrier island off the coast of southern Florida. And as athletic director of the Anna Maria Island Community Center, Ray's able to do what he loves.
I grew up
playing sports. I actually played 2 years of college basketball, so sports has pretty much been my entire life.
The center offers basketball, football, soccer, volleyball, kickball, pretty much any sport, says Ray, an adult or child would want to play. But there's a membership fee to join the center, and Ray says if he didn't work here, he'd have a tough time paying. He's a single dad with full custody of his two young children.
So with one income, having to pay for everything myself because I'm supposed to get child support, but I don't receive it, it would be tough to pay for any extracurricular activities or whatever because most of my money goes to bills and rent.
In our poll, only 15% of lower-income adults say they play sports. Nearly 40% of higher-income adults say they play. And parents who are less well-off are twice as likely to report problems with the cost of their child's sports compared to parents who are better off. Matt Ray's highly committed to having his children play sports, but if not for the center, he says he just couldn't afford it.
It's $120 for the season, which, you know, you play 8 games. So, you know, for 2 kids, you know, that would be, you know, $240. And that'd be tough for me to come up with just an extra $240 just so they could play sports. You know what I mean?
And that's the case for lots of parents. In Baltimore, Lanice White is a single mother who works full-time, some days 10, 12 hours a day, at a doctor's office. Her son Timothy's been playing football since he was 7. It's a club team, which comes with a price tag that hasn't been easy.
At the beginning of the year, you're spending roughly $200, $250. If you have to buy pads or pants, or if you have to buy shoulder pads, that might be another $100 to $150.
When you add it all up, White says, it's a hefty number. And then there's the travel. For playoffs and championship games, her son's team often competes with teams in nearby states, and White often drives carpool. She has to pay for gas, of course, but also for a bunch of hungry kids.
My son would say, "Mommy, can we stop and get something to eat? I'm hungry." And I knew he was hungry because he had just expended so much energy playing in the game.
Just like all the other boys in the car.
So even if my pocket said, "I'm empty, you don't have anything to take out," I had to spend what I had to help feed these other children as well.
White makes about $30,000 a year and often has to make difficult choices.
I have penny pinched and I have not bought things for myself for lunch before to make sure that my son could have the things that he needed that I knew would make him happy and would give him another perspective and view on the world around him. And one of those vehicles was football.
The years of practice have made White's son competitive with other kids, which is critical, she says, as he enters his sophomore year in high school and tries out for varsity teams. White's been able to make this happen for her son, but lots of parents can't.
Who is available to play youth sports? It's certainly not our underserved children. They're being shut out more and more and more.
Daryl Hill chairs Kids Play USA Foundation, a group dedicated to changing policies and practices that make youth sports so costly. Hill played college and professional football in the 1960s. He says well-to-do parents can spend thousands and thousands of dollars building their child's sports skills, high-end equipment, private lessons, and travel as part of an elite team to cities across the country to compete.
The irony of it is, and the bad part about it is, these tournaments and these out-of-state and out-of-town affairs now are becoming a forum that the scouts and coaches at college level are looking to evaluate players. So these kids who might need a scholarship don't get the exposure because they can't afford to go to these tournaments.
The kids who really need to play sports the most, Hill says, are the ones often being left out. And these kids typically don't have all the fancy high-tech gadgets upper-income kids do.
So now you got an idle kid just standing on the corner with nothing to do, particularly in our inner cities. What does that lead to? All of a sudden, homeboy drives up and says, "Hey, we're your family, man. We're your team. Join us."
Even public high school sports, says Hill, come with a fee. Registration costs are sometimes subsidized, but not completely. And there's still the cost of uniforms, equipment, and the challenge for many low-income parents who don't own a car getting their child back and forth to practice. And forgetting the cost for just a moment, Hill says, the overall commercialization of kids' sports is bad news. Everything's organized and monitored. The pressure to win is big, and many kids just aren't having fun anymore, so they quit.
In my generation, we had free play, playground sports, pickup games. We played among ourselves. So every day we would come home from school, and if it was baseball season, we would run out to the sand lot and we would play baseball among ourselves. No adult supervision to speak of. There were leagues around, but it was fun. We just played.
Not so anymore, says Hill, who says kids drop out of sports in droves, which is particularly alarming since the U.S. still struggles so much with overweight and obese children. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
Support for your health comes from Novo Nordisk, noting that more than 1 in 3 adults are at risk for diabetes. Learn more at askscreenknow.com. And from Athena Health, cloud-based services for medical groups and health systems to help physicians work as one across the continuum of care. AthenaHealth.com.
You're listening to Morning Edition from NPR News.
Good morning, it's 8:41, and you are listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up in 10 minutes on Marketplace Morning Report, it's now easier for members of the 1% to book air travel. A new app allows travelers to reserve flights on private jets right from their mobile phones. Could private jet travel actually become cheaper than first class? That plus all the morning's business news here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Kathleen Dunn, and I'll be leading a bus trip to the real land of Lincoln, Springfield, Illinois, to walk in the footsteps of Abraham Lincoln on this 150th anniversary of the year of his death. We'll stop at all the significant landmarks of his life and finally at his tomb. This WPR-sponsored trip is led by Burkhalter Travel. The bus leaves from Madison and Milwaukee October 22nd. Details are at wpr.org/travel.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Iraq's defense minister is said to be unharmed after his convoy came under sniper fire today north of Baghdad. The German government says it's going to spend nearly $7 billion to help resettle thousands of migrants flowing into the country. As Esme Nicholson reports, more than 20,000 people seeking asylum entered Germany over the weekend.
In addition to the provision of extra funds for federal, states, and town councils, the German government plans to increase the capacity of asylum seeker reception centers, finance an additional 3,000 federal police officers, and invest more in integration and language courses.
In Hungary, the country's prime minister is expressing doubts about the effectiveness of any EU quota system. Grace is now churning far out in the Atlantic, the seventh tropical storm this year. Right now, it poses no threat to land hundreds of miles west-southwest of the Cape Verde Islands. Daniel Brown is at the National Hurricane Center in Florida.
We're in the peak of the hurricane season. In fact, for the Atlantic season, the peak date is September 10th, so that is this week. Looks like it will remain likely active for another month or so. That's when things begin to ramp down, is about mid-October.
Forecasters say right now Grace has top sustained winds of almost 50 miles per hour. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton is scheduled to be in Milwaukee Thursday for an organizational meeting at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. The specific location has not been named. Clinton's supporters say she will be at a grassroots meeting hosted by the group Women for Hillary. A Cedarburg priest has been placed on administrative leave pending an investigation into an allegation that he sexually abused a minor in 1977. Archbishop Jerome Listecki said in a letter to parishioners at St. Francis Borgia Catholic Parish
that the Reverend Tom Eichenberger denies the allegation, that it has not been substantiated, and that it's the first such complaint lodged against him. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports the allegation stems from a claim filed in the Archdiocese bankruptcy case, which accuses Eichenberger of molesting a seventh grade boy at Holy Assumption Parish in West Allis. The Archdiocese reported the allegation to the district attorney's office last month, but it declined to prosecute, saying the alleged incident was beyond the statute of limitations. A private investigator will now look into the incident. Tourism businesses in the Wisconsin Dells report attendance has been up as much as 10 to 15% this summer. Visitor and Convention Bureau spokesperson Romy Snyder says some businesses have told her it's the best summer ever. Warmer weather and a drop in gas prices are driving the increase. This is WPR News. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Farmers Insurance. Out to educate everybody about common insurance gaps that can be costly so that no one falls victim to them again. Farmers Insurance. Know the gaps. Learn more at farmers.com/innercircle. From AT&T. With AT&T, the network is on demand, the office is mobile, and the cloud is designed for high security. Learn more at att.com/focus. And from Americans for the Arts at americansforthearts.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning. Those royally beautiful creatures, monarch butterflies, are declining in numbers, partly because a certain weed is disappearing, especially across the American Midwest. The monarch butterfly caterpillar depends on milkweed to survive. And that's something you can help with by planting milkweed, which is really a pretty flower, in your garden. I know. I have lots of milkweed in mine and lots of monarchs. From member station KBIA, Sarah Shariari has more.
A late summer breeze is blowing across the lawns of suburban Jefferson City, Missouri, and over a small garden next to an elementary school.
We're standing here next to this swamp milkweed, which is very robust, about 4 feet tall. And I'm seeing a small monarch caterpillar on the underside of one of the leaves.
That's Carol David of the Missouri Prairie Foundation. She helped create this native plant garden. The caterpillar is stuffing itself. Monarch butterfly caterpillars need milkweed. It's the only food they eat. And in less than 2 weeks, they grow to 2,000 times their original mass. Caterpillars hatched in the late summer and early fall are the longest-lived monarch generation. If they're born east of the Rocky Mountains and make it to adulthood, the deep orange and black butterflies take off along the monarch flyways that stretch for thousands of miles from Canada down through the U.S. and into Mexico, where they winter in the Sierra Madre Mountains. 2013 saw the lowest butterfly count there since recording began in the 90s. Conservation groups are now focusing on the lack of milkweed and its impact on monarch populations.
1.5 billion. We need that many stems out there. And that's going to take about 20 million acres of habitat restoration, which would, if we accomplish that, be the biggest restoration program that has ever been attempted.
Ecologist Chip Taylor heads Monarch Watch at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. His offices are filled with hundreds of little plastic containers of monarch caterpillars, snacking on a leaf paste and breeding butterflies batting their wings in net cages. Taylor says it used to be that farm fields were a great source of milkweed, but in the past decade or so, more targeted use of herbicides, edge-to-edge row crops, and development resulted in dramatic milkweed loss. The Missouri Prairie Foundation is trying to stem that, as is Kansas-based Monarch Watch. It plans to distribute 300,000 milkweed plants next year. In Iowa, the Tallgrass Prairie Center is encouraging farmers and large landowners to plant milkweed and other native prairie plants. Karen Oberhauser is with the conservation umbrella group Monarch Joint Venture. She says that while she doesn't see monarch extinction as an imminent threat, the shrinking population puts the butterfly's spectacular migration at risk.
The eastern North American migration could disappear to the point that it's not really noticeable. I mean, there might still be some monarchs doing it, but it would disappear as an incredible natural phenomenon.
The need for diverse native plant landscapes was highlighted this year when the federal government released a national strategy to promote the health of honeybees and other pollinators. people looking to plant milkweed can turn to local native plant nurseries or conservation groups for help. It's uncertain, though, whether enough milkweed and other native plants can be planted to reverse monarch population loss and preserve the butterfly's migration for future generations. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Shariari in Columbia.
This is NPR News.
It's 8:49, and you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Stay with us. The Marketplace Morning Report is up next. And then classical music starts at 9 and includes film music from Aaron Copland. You can enjoy music from 9 until 3, and then stay with WPR for more news on All Things Considered. Learn more about our schedule at WPR.org.
Support for classical music on WGTD comes from Piasecki Althaus, honoring personal legacies in the circle of life. They believe that every detail counts and every memory matters. Piasecki Althaus is located in Kenosha on 39th Avenue, serving the community since 1931.
France and More will perform a wide range of musical styles. Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to celebrate music from around the world. For more information, visit WPR.org/events.
It's going to be mostly to partly cloudy today in Wisconsin. There is a chance of showers and thunderstorms through this Labor Day. Highs near 80. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy with a chance of rain showers and a slight chance of thunderstorms through the night. Lows in the mid-50s to lower 60s. And tomorrow, mostly to partly cloudy with rain showers continuing. Highs in the mid to upper 70s.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
More signs of a slowing Chinese economy.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Citrix GoToMeeting, the online meeting solution that hosts over 50 million meetings a year. Learn more at gotomeeting.com. And by Angie's List, with reviews of local companies to help users buy services and achieve their goals of remodeled kitchens, freshly painted houses, or new backyards. Angie'sList.com.
From APM in Washington, I'm Amy Scott, in for David Brancaccio. The Shanghai Composite Index fell 2.5% today, as China said its economy grew more slowly last year than originally thought. Meanwhile, China's foreign exchange reserves fell by a record amount in August as Beijing tried to prop up its own currency after the biggest devaluation in two decades. Marketplace China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz joins us from Shanghai to explain what this all means.
I think there's a lot of worry that it might mean more devaluation. You know, China's foreign exchange reserves declined by $94 billion in August. And this is because China's central bank has been busy selling U.S. dollars in order to prop up its own currency. And over the weekend, China's finance minister said China's financial markets are expected to remain stable and that China's currency is not on course for a long-term devaluation. But analysts here aren't so sure about that. If China continues to prop up its currency by drawing down its foreign exchange reserves, more money will leave the country and there will be more pressure to depreciate the Chinese currency even more.
And China also cut its growth rate from last year from 7.4% to 7.3%. Doesn't sound like much, but we are talking about the world's second largest economy, right?
Right. And that modification is equal to $10 trillion that the Chinese economy did not grow by last year. And it's important to remember here that GDP growth figures are a big deal in a country that still tries to plan its economy. Beijing felt that it had to modify last year's figure, tells us that it was much harder for the country to meet the government's growth target last year. And by the way, China's growth target for this year is set at 7%, which would be the slowest pace in 25 years. But if China does make that target, it's still a pretty good growth rate, all things considered.
That's Rob Schmitz, Marketplace China Bureau Chief. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Amy.
Let's do the numbers. U.S. markets are closed on this Labor Day. In Europe, markets are up. London's FT 100 index is up slightly, and Germany's DAX is up about 0.5%. A handful of startup companies like JetSmarter and Victor are hoping to become the Uber of the skies. Much like the popular private taxi service, these companies are designing apps to make it easier than ever to fly on private jets. Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Will the gilded skies ever be the same? A wave of entrepreneurs want to take advantage of all the empty seats on private jets and lure people away from commercial air travel with promises of lower prices. Industry analyst Robert W. Mann Jr. doubts this is going to fly.
The merely affluent aren't going to be chartering private jet to St. Martin from New York. That's just beyond the means of anybody who isn't just, stupid rich.
Mann says that St. Martin flight round trip would cost $80,000 to $90,000, depending on the jet. Or you could fly from JFK to the Caribbean island first class for as little as $1,000. Seth Kaplan is with Airline Weekly.
The economics between private jets and commercial air travel are just far more different than the economics between a private car and a taxi.
Kaplan says the economies of scale you get with commercial carriers are going to win out every time. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Epson, with workforce multifunction printers powered by Precision Core technology. Built for office and workgroup printing, they're designed to help businesses run at full speed. Where there's business, there's Epson. And by Zillow, with homes for sale, historical pricing data, and photos available on Zillow.com or on their mobile apps. Zillow, find your way home. And by LegalZoom, resources to help protect intellectual property, including trademark, copyrights, patents, and independent attorney consultations. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Tennessee is known for its whiskey, especially Jack Daniel's, the most popular American whiskey in the world. But until recently, that state only had 3 distilleries. Now, thanks to changes in the liquor law, whiskey distilleries are popping up all over the place. Just getting that whiskey to market takes a long time. So WPLN's Emily Siner reports the new distilleries are getting creative.
The big warehouse of distillery Speakeasy Spirits smells like fermenting alcohol, which is exactly what's happening in giant bubbling tubs in the middle of the room. Dozens of barrels line the walls.
We're going to start construction on a big barrel house because we're running out of room.
Jenny Pennington is one of the founders of the Nashville-based company. She says it costs a lot to produce whiskey. You have to buy the equipment, the barrels, the space to keep them. But this whiskey has to age for several years before it goes on the shelf.
Every time you lay down a barrel of whiskey, you're pretty much writing a check and, you know, have to put it on the shelf for, 4 to 6 years, however long you're going to age it.
So as a faster form of payment, Speakeasy has started making vodka.
And it's wonderful because you can make vodka today and, it's ready for the market tomorrow.
You could do rum, you could do gin, you could do vodka, you could do unaged whiskey.
Clay Risen has written a book about American whiskey, and he says this kind of business model isn't just happening in Tennessee. The number of distilleries have boomed nationwide, but he says it's tough to get started if you only want to make aged whiskey.
If you're looking to get investors, it can be very hard to convince people that, hey, I've never done this before, but you should give me money because it's going to pay off.
Charlie Nelson had a hard time getting funding. He owns Nelson's Greenbrier Distillery in Nashville. So he says,
my family and I, we decided to put up everything that we own to personally guarantee a loan.
Now he's putting away a couple of barrels of whiskey every day.
My triple great-grandfather's original recipe.
Nelson's selling an unaged version in the meantime to bring in some cash. He says everything about this business requires a lot of patience.
And if you rush it, you might make a mistake.
His whiskey should be ready for market next year. By that time, more Tennessee companies may have joined the slow and steady race. In Nashville, I'm Emily Siner for Marketplace.
The later Labor Day this year added a week to Hollywood's summer movie season, and it's been a strong one. Ticket sales are up by more than 10% compared to last summer, according to RentTrack. As always, there were winners and losers. Jurassic World topped the box office, taking in more than $1.6 billion in global sales. In Washington, I'm Amy Scott with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And this is Wisconsin Public Radio. You can hear Marketplace every weekday during Morning Edition and more on the day's business news on All Things Considered starting at 3 o'clock, followed by Marketplace at 6:30. All coming up here on WPR.
Support for WPR comes from Ephraim Door County, presenting the inaugural Ephraim Hill Climb and Concours d'Elegance, pre- and post-war sports cars in a weekend of showmanship, September 11th through the 13th. EphraimHillClimb.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at VeroInternationalCuisine.com. You're listening to WGTD HD.